I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is off today. It's Here and Now. A report in the Washington Post says that unnamed Pentagon officials are calling for the Bush administration to take public and private actions to topple the government of Iran. And some White House officials say the recent bombings in Saudi Arabia were coordinated by al-Qaeda members inside Iran. Jim Muir reports for the BBC. He joins us from Tehran. And Jim, tell us, what's the reaction there to some of the heated words coming out of Washington?
Well, the official reaction is simply basically to deny everything, although on the accusations relating to the presence alleged of al-Qaeda operatives, there has been a kind of admission that they are holding a number of al-Qaeda people, but also they're saying officially that these are not important people, they're not high-ranking people. So there is a kind of tacit admission that there is a little bit of al-Qaeda presence here, but there is absolutely no admission that this is condoned. In other words, they're saying we fight al-Qaeda wherever we find it. We arrest these people whenever we can. And we were doing that long before the Americans were taking interest in that particular group.
Well, yeah, there is actually a split in the White House, which has become a familiar one, with the State Department saying that there should be more diplomacy with Iran and the Defense Department talking tougher. Is there a sense that, as some are saying, that there might be al-Qaeda in parts of Iran that Iran has no control over?
Well, that is a part of the tacit admission, I think, and certainly third-party Western diplomats here, not American, obviously, because we don't have them here, are saying that they do believe there are some al-Qaeda people, including some important ones here, but they're in two minds about Iranian involvement in that. In other words, they don't really know whether Iran is condoning it or simply doesn't even know they're there.
Jim, we heard this kind of heated language following the Iraq War aimed towards Syria, and that seems to have quieted down. Is there a sense that this language aimed towards Iran might just be tough talk or more than that?
Well, I think some Iranians are, and both officials and unofficials people, are concerned that the U.S. may simply have already decided, or at least hardliners decided, that Iran should be next on the list for hostile attention after Afghanistan and Iraq.
Are there some within Iran who would also like to see that happen?
Certainly on the popular level, you do hear that quite a bit, especially from people like taxi drivers, cab drivers, that there is quite a sentiment saying they've done Afghanistan, they've done Iraq, please come and do us, because they simply see no other way of getting rid of the clerical regime. Now, in the past week, we've seen two letters circulated by, signed and circulated by a large number of intellectuals in the first case, in the second case, a large number of reformist MPs expressing huge frustration at the fact that the vastly elected and popular reformist leaders simply have got nowhere because of the entrenched unelected minority who've been blocking them.
But would this kind of language and would U.S. intervention at this point destroy the reformist movement? Is there a chance that the reformist movement could work by itself?
Well, this is the big debate, and it's one where the U.S., for example, falls out with Britain, which believes in constructive engagement, encouraging the reform movement, whereas the U.S. appears at the moment to have written off the reformists as, you know, a friendly smile on the face of an unacceptable regime, and to be prepared to do what they can to get rid of that regime. Where I think they may be misreading the situation is talk of encouraging a revolution or some kind of mass movement against the regime here. There's absolutely no sign here of that being a feasible possibility. There really is no credible movement, no credible organization poised to rise up against the regime.
Well, Jim, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Jim Muir reports from Iran for the BBC. He spoke to us from Tehran. Over 8,100 U.S. soldiers are still missing in action in Korea. The unidentified remains of 800 of them rest at a memorial in Japan. But last week, Army lawyers came to the Minneapolis, Minnesota home of Donald Lilydahl to tell him that his brother, Private First Class Ronald Lilydahl, is the first of the Korean War's unknown soldiers to be named. Donald, another brother Bill, and Joe, a comrade of Ron's, all join us now. Don, you didn't enlist because you broke your ankle, and do I understand you're Ronald's twin?
Yes, I am.
So you were watching anxiously from the home front while Bill Lilydahl, you're up there in Plymouth, Minnesota. You actually were fighting in the same battle with Ronald?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Okay, well, you guys hold on for a second because we also have Joseph Pupilo. He's in Gary, Indiana. And Joe, you were in the battle with Ronald and Bill as well. Tell us, what happened on that day, November 28th, 1950?
Well, we returned to relieve a company that was trapped, and we returned to an area which we called Turkey Ridge. It received that name because we had celebrated. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
We had celebrated our Thanksgiving dinner there a few days earlier. And when we arrived there...
Boy, this is so tough for you, even 53 years later.
Well, I was glad to hear from Bill. He called me here about a month ago to tell me about it.
To tell you that the remains had been identified.
Yes, yes. And I was shocked. And it was, you know, good news, bad news.
Yeah. How is it bad news?
Well, you know, it...
Because it's so painful.
That's right. Yeah. I'm sorry. Brought back the memories. And, you know...
Oof.
What happened was that we'd both settled down for the night, and we thought we had a nice, comfortable evening with our warm sleeping bags, and the first sergeant came up and says, I need one of you guys on the flank. It must have been about 10 or 11 when I left Ron, and I went over to the flank, and at dawn we heard a lot of firing, and when I went back to the foxhole... I saw Ron laying there, and I just thought he was asleep, but he had succumbed during the night.
He'd been shot?
He had been shot. That was the last I saw of him.
And then, Bill, you're in the same battle in a different area. Joe had to come to you with the news.
I didn't see Joe until, I think it was a day or two, Joe.
Yes.
And he told me what happened. Probably didn't sink into me right at that time because there was so much stuff going on, you know, with cold weather and people shooting and hollering and screaming and the whole bit. And right now, when I got the word from my brother about what was going on, it seemed like it was just yesterday.
Yeah.
It just don't seem like 50 years went by. I know when I talked to Joe, he probably felt more about it when I talked to him on the phone the last time and right now today than we did then.
Yeah.
Well, there was, you know, a fully reinforced company, I believe, consisted of 250 people. And I think when we landed and when we got back down out of the north, there was 35 remaining out of the company. And like Bill said, back then there were so many things going on. I guess you were just relieved to... keep warm and get out of the place, and you know, those memories are just pushed back. And
You know, the one thing I remember is when we got to the bottom of the hill where they had trucks waiting for us, they had 10 trucks for Charlie coming, and I think we used 2.
Yeah.
That was about right, Joe.
Yeah, I know. And then, you know, this is a terrible thing, but I've over the years just presumed that Ron's body had came back intact, because it was intact when I last saw it. You know, he was just curled up there like he was sleeping. And the bodies that were put into these trucks were in all kinds of positions because they froze. And what position they were in when they passed away is the position they were put on the trucks.
Donald, had you heard about what happened to your twin, Ronald?
Well, yeah, my parents got a letter. So. Yeah, I never knew what Joe said. I never knew any of that. It was pretty touching. Never knew what happened there. Bill never talked much about it, so now I know it all. So.
Yeah.
Pretty well shot when Ron was killed.
Yeah. Don, does it help this identification, the first, I mean, there's hundreds of others who aren't. Does this help you?
Well, yeah, this I feel wonderful about. This is finally got a closure, and this is almost like a miracle. I mean, to pick him out of all those people, yeah, really something.
And Joe and Bill, all of you, it reminds us that there are hundreds of others, thousands of others from that war, and it's a war that not many people talk about. I mean, you know, they say there's a TV show about it that ran longer than the war, and, you know, MASH.
Yes.
Well, they had 33,000, almost 34,000 people killed over in that short period of time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that it's a forgotten war. I think it happened so closely after the Second World War that it was a generation that we were all doing what we had to do to protect our country.
Well, I'm thinking too that it's a war that may be forgotten. But certainly not as we look at Korea closer and closer, and certainly not by you guys.
Well, that's true. You know, when I look at some of these pictures when I was 20 years old, I looked like I just got out of high school.
Well, you did.
You did, yeah.
I was 19. I experienced my 19th birthday there.
Yeah, and Ronald was 21 when he was there.
Yeah.
In August.
Yeah. Well, we want to thank you for helping us remember your brother and friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don Lilly Dahl, Bill Lilly Dahl, and Joe Pupillo talking about their friend and brother, Ronald Lilly Dahl, whose returned remains will be buried in June.
J. Thomas Auburn, Waterville, Maine. Ryan Anthony Beaupre, Bloomington, Illinois. Brian Matthew Kennedy, Houston, Texas. Kendall Damon Watersby, Baltimore, Maryland.
162 American soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines died in Operation Iraqi Freedom, the recent war in Iraq. On this Memorial Day, 2003, we'll pause to remember those men and women as well.
Jose Gutierrez, Los Angeles, California. Therrell Childers, Harrison County, Mississippi. Brandon Tobler. Christopher Scott Seifert. Thomas Mullen Adams, La Mesa, California.
Michael E. Bitts, Ventura, California. David K. Fribley, Lee, Florida. Jose A. Garibay, Orange, California. Jorge A. Gonzalez, Los Angeles, California.
Philip A. Jordan, Brazoria, Texas. Frederick E. Picorni, Jr., Nye, Nevada. Thomas J. Slocum, Adams, Colorado. Brian Rory Busing, Cedar Key, Florida.
Randall Kent Rosacker, San Diego, California. Howard Johnson II, Mobile, Alabama. Michael J. Williams, Arizona. Patrick R. Nixon, St. Louis, Missouri.
Nicholas M. Hodson, Smithville, Missouri. Jamal R. Addison, Roswell, Georgia. George Edward Buggs, Barnwell, South Carolina. Robert J. Dowdy, Cleveland, Ohio.
James M. Keel, Des Moines, Iowa. Johnny Villarreal Mata, El Paso, Texas. Lorianne Piestawa, Tuba City, Arizona. Brandon Ulysses Sloan, Bedford, Ohio.
Donald Ralph Walters, Salem.
This is WBUR. Washington is turning up the heat on Iran after saying al-Qaeda was operating out of the Islamic Republic. For more on the story, go to WBUR.org. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Audi, offering Quattro all-wheel drive and every model line available at local Boston Audi dealers. They catered to fairs since 1979, creating chef-inspired cuisines for intimate dinner parties to festive galas in New England. Information on the web at thecateredtofair.com.
Something new is coming to WBUR this June. It's the first annual WBUR online auction, and you can help make it a success. If you have an item or service you would like to donate to the auction, please let us know. We'll thank you by providing your company or organization with exposure on the air and on our website. To make a donation, call 800-909-9287 or log on to WBUR.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A close-up of the Hawk-like B-2 stealth bomber readying for takeoff at an Air Force base in Missouri. The rising sun at daybreak as a sentry keeps watch over the tomb of the unknown soldier at Arlington National Cemetery. female Marines dressed in full battle gear marching into a pool to train for a combat swim at Parris Island in South Carolina. These are just a few of the images featured in A Day in the Life of the United States Armed Forces, an enormous new book of photographs shot by 125 of the world's top photojournalists in one single day, October 22, 2002, at various places throughout the world. A Day in the Life offers an insider's view of what life is like for new recruits, battle-hardened veterans, rookies, and family members of military personnel. It also contains a foreword by veteran World War II correspondent Walter Cronkite, accompanied by, what else? A photo of the dashing young Cronkite in his correspondent's uniform, pad and pen in hand, ready to record history. Well, the editor and co-producer of this ambitious collection is Matthew Nathans, and he joins us on the line from San Francisco. Matthew, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your air.
Some of the pictures are so simple in their everydayness. I've never seen so many pictures in a military book of people brushing their teeth.
Absolutely. Dental hygiene is important.
And they're just brushing them in far more exotic places.
I don't know. Where do you brush your teeth?
No, in the mouth, but in the desert.
Okay, just checking. This is what it's all about. We asked the photographers to go behind the headlines, show us what a typical day in the life of the United States Armed Forces is like. These are the people, and I apologize for the cliche up front, but we sleep at night because they don't. In order to gain access to them, first of all, we needed extraordinary access because the pictures work best when they're behind the scenes. And the images are really never-before-seen images of the men and women of the armed forces.
How long did you have to work to get that, as you said, that access?
It came very quickly. We were actually the first embeds. We worked with the Department of Defense, and they understood the editorial independence of the project, so it worked quite well.
Well, and there on page 18 is David Hume Kennerly's portrait of Donald Rumsfeld arriving at work at 6:22 in the morning. David Hume Kennerly, of course, a White House photographer.
The cofactor for all the photographers that they had to be the best. We had the best of the civilian photographers, the best of the military photographers. Kennerly won a Pulitzer Prize. The military photographers, many of them were military photographers of the year.
And it's all branches of the armed forces on this day.
All five branches, Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, Marine Corps.
For such a huge project, we know you would need backers. We see that the project was sponsored by, is it Boeing?
Yes, it's interesting. Boeing came in when the project was completely finished and almost ready to go to press.
Oh, okay, because that was going to be a question I'm sure many would have. There's an awful lot of beautiful photographs of flying machines. And so that had nothing to do with the sponsorship?
Not only that, but I would suggest that a great number of them are not Boeing aircraft.
Okay. All right. But what about another thing that someone might point to? I look through this beautiful, huge book, and it's about the armed forces, and no one gets hurt. And no one's really fighting. There's no blood. Is that a real depiction of the armed forces and what they have to do?
This was shot on one day. What crossed our lens made the book. If there was no blood on that day, it's not in the book. And believe me, if there were combat that day in which there was bloodshed, it would have been in the book. There wasn't. It's about who these men and women are.
There is some troop movement in Afghanistan captured.
Correct. It was a night operation by, I think, the 82nd Airborne. And then there's the mundane aspects of just protecting our borders on patrol in North Korea, or in Korea, rather.
Well, in fact, I was going to mention, I love the picture of the soldier in the DMZ. He said his motto is ahead of all of them, and he's patrolling on the DMZ. I'm open to a picture of a Navy SEAL. Some of these pictures were harder to take than others. This picture is so evocative of, I think it's the scene from Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, it's the Martin Sheen picture, as we called it. It looks like that one scene where Marty Sheen rises out of the water.
Camouflage over his face. This Navy SEAL that's photographed by Nick Kelsch apparently only agreed to be photographed if his face was half below the water, as Martin Sheen's was, and he's got the green camouflage over his face.
The SEALs take their mission very seriously, as they should. They don't want to be photographed. They want to be able to appear in foreign countries on missions and not have any identification of them that existed prior. That's why the picture was taken that way.
You can follow along online, so go to our website, here-now.org. I'm on page 92 now, and there's this extraordinary scene of all these, let's see, they're divers, and they're jumping into a pool. We've seen that. I mean, I feel I've seen soldiers holding onto their face masks with their flippers, jumping into a pool for some exercise. But the next picture is from underwater. And it's sort of a chorus line
rockets, if you will, of soldiers with their flippers on.
Yeah, Busby Berkeley. David Dubois is probably the premier underwater photographer in the nation. And David Dubois went to the Special Operations Warfare School in Key West, Florida to take that picture. They loved it. They've never seen that image before either.
There's a photograph that I'm looking at now on page 84. Knowing the title of this book, you'd wonder, what is this picture doing here? It's a little girl in one of those carriers that attaches to a shopping cart.
Right.
And she's in a store, and it's the Army Base Commissary. And there's people all around, and then suddenly you see that all the cornflakes behind her have big American flags on them.
What makes that picture so fascinating is it could be Iowa, could be New Jersey. It's only when you read the captions you realize that this American supermarket is in Germany.
Yeah, you don't leave anything out. We've got soldiers carrying a python snake, slithering through mud in Quantico. There's incredible submarine photos. Camels in a desert on a test range in Kuwait, and then my favorite four pages that honor the great dogs and other animals that have served. There's dolphins and a horse and a big bulldog. That's right.
Chesty, named after Chester Puller, the commandant of the Marine Corps. He's a Marine Corps symbol. There are pictures which I refer you to from Vietnam. There are Americans even today working, looking for remains of other Americans who died during the Vietnam War.
Well, Matthew, thank you.
My pleasure. Have a happy Memorial Day.
You too. Matthew Nathans, editor and co-producer of the new book, A Day in the Life of the United States Armed Forces. To see some of the pictures, visit our website here-now.org. Last Friday on Here and Now, we talked about the number of Iraqis killed in the recent war. Today, Memorial Day, we're remembering the U.S. military personnel who died.
Kimafum A. Chanawangsi, Waterford, Connecticut. Edward J. Anguiano, Brownsville, Texas. Thomas A. Blair, Oklahoma.
Eric J. Orlovsky, Buffalo, New York. Gregory P. Sanders, Indiana. Evan T. James, Hancock, Illinois. Bradley S. Korthaz, Scott, Iowa.
Gregory Stone, Boise, Idaho. Michael Van Johnson, Jr.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by David L. Babson & Company, investment advisors to private clients and institutions, working to help clients build and preserve wealth since 1940. David L. Babson in Cambridge and on the web at dlbabson.com. The Elliott Hotel, recently named one of the greatest hotels in the world by Travel and Leisure Magazine 2003. Reservations at 617-267-1607. The Worcester Art Museum presenting Samurai Spirit, exploring the heroics and culture of Japan's legendary warriors, on view through June 22nd, on the web at worcesterart.org. Rain heavy at times this afternoon with some fog, temperatures dropping to near 50 degrees.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk.
What do you usually get when you make a transaction online?
A lifetime's worth of spam in your inbox?
No. Wouldn't it be better if you ended up with, like, a brand new 2003 Subaru Baja?
Duh.
Well, WBUR is giving away a Subaru Baja from Cityside Subaru in Arlington. And all you have to do to enter the contest is make a pledge online.
No one's going to try to sell me, like, hair enhancement cream or anything like
no,
that?
No. Pledge now at WBUR.org and good luck winning the Subaru.
Enter before this Friday's deadline, and remember, your contribution helps pay for the news.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush is off to France this week. Can this international marriage be saved?
It's really getting snipey. Last week's vote by the UN Security Council to drop 13 years of sanctions on Iraq was a step in the right direction, but, the Secretary of State made it clear that we still haven't forgotten.
And the late jazz trumpet player Chet Baker, so tormented, so talented.
Chet Baker is a guy who felt an enormous amount of pressure, an enormous amount of anger, and he wanted to escape.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
I'm Dave Fadiff. President Bush is attending a Memorial Day ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery. The president took part in the annual Wreath Lane ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and paid tribute to the nation's war dead.
Today we honor the men and women who have worn the nation's uniform and were last seen on duty from the battles of Iraq and Afghanistan to the conflicts in Korea and Vietnam, to the trials of World War, to the struggles that made us a nation.
In his Memorial Day proclamation, the president said the men and women who fought in Iraq and all the nation wars have won every hour we live in freedom. U.S. Central Command says a soldier was killed today and another wounded when their convoy was ambushed in northern Iraq. The attackers opened fire with machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades as a U.S. convoy was headed to a base about 120 miles north of Baghdad. American military officials also say another American soldier was killed and a second wounded in southern Iraq yesterday when a munitions dump they were guarding exploded. The incident is believed to have been an accident. Rescue teams carry on the search today for a sailor missing from the USS Nassau. Coast Guard and Navy boats and planes are scouring the Atlantic waters for Petty Officer First Class Sean Dale, who missed roll call yesterday. Another sailor fell from the Nassau 2 days earlier. His body has not been found. It's a Memorial Day homecoming for 2,300 Marines and sailors of the 24th Marine Expeditionary Unit. Marines returned to North Carolina after 9 months of duty that included combat in Iraq. Families gathered at the base pier at Camp Lejeune as their loved ones were taken ashore in three ships this morning. It's the first major Marine Corps unit homecoming from Iraq. UN nuclear inspectors are returning to Iraq. Officials say the nuclear inspectors will be checking on radioactive material at Iraq's biggest nuclear facility, but the U.S. has limited the scope of the mission. The nuclear inspectors will be limited to a nuclear complex about 30 miles southeast of Baghdad that is dormant. At least 16 people injured and power is still out in many areas, but officials say they're lucky that this morning's earthquake in northern Japan was centered deep under the ocean. Japanese officials say the quake measured a magnitude of 7. It could be felt in Tokyo, 250 miles away. On Wall Street, the markets are closed for the Memorial Day holiday. It's 33.5 minutes past the hour. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Sudbury Granite and Marble, direct importer and fabricator of granite and marble surfaces for homes in Boston and on the Cape and the Islands, in Sudbury, Mendon, and West Hartford, Connecticut. Mississippi's telephone number is 800-230-6789. Affinia Dumont, an executive fitness suite hotel in New York, where healthy meets high tech. Information at Affinia.com, AFFINIA.com. Red Sox in New York this afternoon to take on Roger Clemens and the Yankees. Clemens going for career win number 300. Tim Wakefield starts for the Sox. Rain heavy at times this afternoon with fog, temperatures dropping to near 50. Rainy and foggy in the 40s tonight. Tomorrow cloudy, chance of rain in the morning in the 50s. Some morning fog in the Cape and the Islands. Wednesday a cloudy day in the 60s. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is off today. It's Here and Now. Sacre bleu! President Bush travels to France this week aboard Air Force One, which serves freedom toast instead of French toast, and after threatening to stay just over the border in Switzerland during this week's tete-a-tete with leaders of the Group of Eight industrial nations. There has been rapprochement. Bush has decided not to snub French President Jacques Chirac. He will stay in France. Well, here to put Franco-American relations in perspective are members of our D.C. roundtable. Andrea Stone covers Washington for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi there.
And Bill Douglas covers the Capitol for Newsday. Hi, Bill.
How are you?
I'm fine. And let's start with you, Bill. Are relations thawing? And if they are, why?
They're thawing in some parts of the administration, but are still pretty frosty in others. Secretary Powell last week praised France for voting along with everybody else on the UN resolution regarding sanctions against Iraq. But at the same time, the Defense Department has taken some steps that show that the relations are still pretty much cool. They've pulled back on their participation in an air show and disinvited France to participate in a military exercise next year. So you sort of have this push-me-pull-you with the U.S.-Franco relations right now.
Right. And then, of course, Andrew, there was that letter that we reported on, the French letter accusing the United States of knowingly disseminating false information.
Right. There's a lot of charges going back and forth that the French have somehow helped the Iraqis, or have helped Iraqi fugitives get away by giving them false passports or visas, which the French vehemently deny. It's really getting snipey. And as Bill was saying, last week's vote by the UN Security Council to drop 13 years of sanctions on Iraq was a step in the right direction. But, you know, the Secretary of State made it clear that we still haven't forgotten what the France did during the war.
That's right. He was asked, will the French be punished? And he said, yes.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, as Bill said, you know, they were disinvited to a military exercise that's going to be held next year in Nevada. I mean, this is a fellow member of NATO. You know, that's a pretty big deal. It really sends a strong signal that we're, you know, pretty ticked off.
But after sending the letter, they also have been working pretty hard to reach out to Americans. The French ambassador was traveling across the country, sort of a roadshow.
And French tourism officials are also wining and dining travel writers here in the U.S. to try to send the message, hey, you know, Paris is still there, Americans come. But they really have suffered. Tourism is down, the French wines are not selling, and they're worried over there in France.
Well, we've done stories here about, you know, people possibly boycotting French products and how it could end up hurting American businesses. Obopan put a sign in its window saying, you know, we're American. But Bill, what are the bigger trade questions? What is the other money lost between the countries over this kerfuffle?
Well, the U.S. and French money are intertwined. A lot of U.S. brands are actually owned by French corporations. The French stock market has a heavy foreign investment, including U.S. investment. So there are some fears among some companies that the U.S. might cut its nose to spite its face in this situation.
Well, if there's some punishment, it's clear that the president also rewards his friends. He's given only three state dinners so far in his presidency, all to supporters, Mexico, Poland, and last week the president of the Philippines, where we should say French wine was not served. But if the president has a memory for lack of loyalty, where else have we seen this tendency in him, and what effect does it have?
Well, it's a funny thing with France. If you remember, France was part of the so-called Axis of Weasel, which included the Germans and, to some extent, the Russians. They have not had the same degree of suffering as France has. France has sort of been held out there as an example of what can go wrong if you cross the United States.
Right, and I think, you know, this White House has a very long memory when you go up against the United States. I mean, for the Mexican holiday of Cinco de Mayo, President Bush came out and at an event and didn't mention the president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, who was a very adamant opponent of us going to war in Iraq. A visit by the head of the Canadian government was canceled. Canada wasn't on our side either. And yet, as you did see last week, the president of the Philippines, a very staunch ally in the war on terrorism, they have a real problem there in the south of the Philippines, was feted, and a state dinner, all the stops were pulled out.
But, Andrew, do you think, as Bill says, that, for instance, on the economic front, it might come back to bite him, or do you think it makes him look better and stronger?
Well, I think some observers think it's not a very good idea. I mean, look, we share a very long alliance going back to Lafayette with the French. The French came to our aid, and we came to the French aid. And it was interesting last week or a couple of weeks ago, the Treasury Secretary Snow was in France and was touring the cemetery at Normandy, which has over 9,000 graves of people who died at D-Day and afterwards during World War II. So, you know, you just can't forget, you just can't put aside an alliance like that. That goes back to the beginnings of our country.
And, Bill, it might not make for the best photo opportunities when President Bush travels to France. In addition to all the politics we've been talking about, the president infuriated a lot of Europeans by saying last week that banning genetically modified crops from the U.S., by doing that, Europeans were causing starvation around the world. So I'm just wondering, what do you think the public reception is going to be like?
Well, the beauty about where this summit's going to be is it's pretty hard to get a vast number of people there. Bush probably won't see a lot of protesters. It's well enough away from Paris. He won't have to worry about that. I mean, there could be like thousands of people on the street in Paris and they won't know.
Okay. Andrea, one last quick question. On the domestic front, Congress off for the week. But when they come back, you know, polls are showing that the large number of Americans really don't want that tax cut as much as they want their health care paid for.
Yeah, I mean, the polls have shown that the public is lukewarm about this tax cut. And once that issue is behind us, health care might just come up to the fore. I mean, all the Democratic candidates are, in the last couple of weeks, have put out their ideas for what to do with the health system. So maybe that will be the new topic of conversation, or maybe not. You know, who knows what's going to happen in Iraq, and who knows there'll be another terrorist attack.
Well, let's hope not.
Yeah.
And thank you both, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your Memorial Day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Douglas covers the Capitol for Newsday. Andrea Stone covers Washington for USA Today. And in Washington this morning, President Bush marked Memorial Day at Arlington National Cemetery. He paid tribute to the troops in Afghanistan and Iraq and said that on this day, Americans pray for peace. Well, we offer this prayer, our continued roll call, the names of the Americans killed in the most recent war.
Brian M. McPhillips, Pembroke, Massachusetts. Dwayne R. Rios, Hammond, Indiana. Tristan N. Aitken, State College, Pennsylvania. Larry K. Brown, Jackson, Mississippi.
Stephen A. Booker, Apollo, Pennsylvania. Edward Smith, Chicago, Illinois. Gregory P. Huxley, Jr., Forestport, New York. Kelly S. Pruitt, Alabama.
Lincoln D. Hollinshead, Malden, Illinois. Andrew Julian Aviles, Palm Beach, Florida. Jesus Martin Antonio Medellin, Fort Worth, Texas. Jeffrey J. Kaler, Clifton, Virginia.
Anthony S. Miller, San Antonio, Texas. Eric B. Das, Amarillo, Texas. William R. Watkins III, Danville, Virginia.
Juan Guadalupe Garza, Jr., Temperance, Michigan. Henry L. Brown, Natchez, Mississippi.
On Memorial Day, I think of my dad, the proud Marine, and the time I had to stop his funeral and throw the minister out. Let me backtrack here. That my adored dad was a Marine was hardwired in each of us kids at birth. We knew how he'd lied about his age to enlist, how the Marines became the family he didn't have, how he'd fought at Guadalcanal, came home, led a move to force a local college to go co-ed, attended the school on the GI Bill, and then married my mom, the May Queen, for good measure. How they bought their first home for $5,000 on that GI Bill. As kids, we'd sneak in his dresser drawer to look at medals and terrible little pictures. Old black-and-white photographs with perforated edges, my dad staring at the camera, surrounded by dead friends and enemies, body parts. Maybe he drank in part to forget some of those images. He drank like successful men who'd survived the war drank back then, martinis at lunch and dinner, beer while golfing. He was an exquisite golfer. But after several decades, the liver failed. We all gathered at his first deathbed, from which he got up and went into an alcohol recovery program, much to his and our shock. But as it turns out, a liver can only regenerate so much, and a year later, he fell ill and died suddenly on Christmas Day. Our family was stunned and tried to catch up with Dad's second family, already organizing a funeral. There were so many stories that day, but I will tell you just one, and it's true. Even if it sounds like I'm making it up. It seems that, at the end, Dad met an ambulance-chasing preacher apparently trolling hospital halls for quickie funeral candidates. Our beloved family minister had long ago died, so I guess my dad signed this guy up for the service he knew was coming, even if I didn't. When he arrived, the preacher seemed surprised at the hundreds of people who were there, but that surprise turned to astonishment when he took to the pulpit for the eulogy, looked out over the crowd, and saw Robert Duvall. Yes, that Robert Duvall. My sister was married to him at the time, and suddenly the minister stopped looking at his watch and began to speak. Some men, he said, just travel through life. They have peaks and valleys. Floyd Young's was such a man. But some men, and here he was speaking directly to Robert Duvall, some men achieve greatness. I kid you not. He went on like that for 10 minutes, gesturing with pity to my dad's little box he'd been cremated, then grandly over to his new best friend, Robert Duvall. I remember looking down the pew at the people I loved, their tear-stained faces that had been contorted in grief, now frozen in disbelief. "Robin," my sister mouthed, "do something." And I did. I stood up. I said, "Excuse me, Pastor, thank you very much, but we won't be needing you anymore." Then I took to the altar and talked about my dad, about the war, about the gift he had given us, his children, by showing us that it was never too late to make life-changing decisions, about how his liver had failed, but not his will. And then it was over. But what to do with Dad? He'd wanted to be buried under a tree on the golf course, but that was illegal. So, as he had years before, we turned to the Marines. Come spring, we traveled out to the Veterans Cemetery on Long Island. I worried at first. There were rows and rows of white crosses. It felt so impersonal. But they played taps, affixed his cross, and I realized how perfect it was and how very wrong that minister had been. We left Dad there, grave 239B, section V, forever at attention, indistinguishable from 323,000 men buried around him, and special. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Saunders Hotel Group of Boston, proud recipient of former President Bush's Environment and Conservation Gold Medal Award, 1992. Boston Botanicals, offering comprehensive interior plant service and design to businesses in Greater Boston and proprietors of a unique flower shop in downtown Boston. Come explore the countryside and distinctive cuisine of Tuscany and Umbria with Sylvia Poggioli on our next Citizens of the World tour this summer. Proceeds help pay for the news. For more information, call 800-909-9287. Rain heavy at times this afternoon with fog, temperatures dropping to near 50 degrees. Rain and fog continuing tonight in the 40s. Tomorrow cloudy with a chance of rain in the morning and temperatures in the 50s. Some morning fog on the Cape and the islands. Wednesday a cloudy day in the 60s. 52 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young. It's here and now.
My funny Valentine.
He was the James Dean of jazz.
Sweet comic Valentine.
He was from Oklahoma, but moved to California. He was the epitome of West Coast cool, hated by the East Coast contingent led by Miles Davis, loved by women and men everywhere for his beautiful looks, which he destroyed in a drug-drenched life and a violent death plummeting out a window in Amsterdam in 1988. How could a life that once symbolized the American dream end so disastrously? And why do we still care? Well, this music gives a hint. James Gavin has written a book on the fallen jazz great. It's called Deep in a Dream, The Long Night of Chet Baker. And James Gavin joins us in the studio to talk about and listen to the music of Chet Baker. Welcome, James.
Thank you for having me.
Well, pretty grim stuff.
Yes, you
just flip through the book. Everywhere the eye falls. Here's some quotes. No one could stand to see Chet Baker suffer. He rarely returned the sympathy. Away from his trumpet, he didn't know what honesty was. Deception had been second nature since childhood. You know, images of Baker unconscious in a bathroom stall, buying heroin, cheating on women, a horrendous father. You know, do you, as one of your reviewers said, do you dislike your subject?
No, I don't dislike my subject. I was fascinated by the sordidness of all of this. What I did was present the truth, and much of the truth is very ugly. And believe me, all through the writing of this book, I was looking for little rays of sunshine and glimpses of humor. And what I found was irony, black humor, but not yak-yak laughs, because it is simply not that kind of a story. I don't know too many happy junkies. I don't know about you.
Let's be reminded of what all the excitement was about in the first place. How did Chet Baker burst on the scene? You know, where does he fit in the overall jazz scene?
It happened very quickly in Hollywood in 1952. The jazz community, the insiders of jazz on the West Coast in 1952, became aware of him and instantly became very jealous of him because he was a beautiful white boy
seemingly out of nowhere, who got the chance to play for a hot minute in a band with Charlie Parker. And it was later that year, in 1952, that Chet Baker and Jerry Mulligan together, the great saxophonist, arranger, and composer, were the two front men of the hottest quartet in Hollywood. And it defined West Coast jazz for the next several years, what they were doing together. The sound of cool was being born then, and what cool meant is that you didn't play a lot of notes, you left a lot of space, you didn't raise your voice, and you didn't reveal very much. It was the sound of the easy life, and these guys were not going to play like daredevils because, you know, the responses are a little dimmed, things are float along a little more slowly. Mm-hmm. And that is, I must say, one of the reasons that the sound of cool was born.
Do you think that the music would have come out of him the way it did if he wasn't getting into drugs? And if he wasn't, you know, another element, you know, fleeing from an overwhelming mother and an abusive father, you know, how much of all of that made his music?
It is so hard to distinguish Chet Baker's music from drugs, because from the beginning of the time he was playing, he was high on something. Chet Baker is a guy who felt an enormous amount of pressure, an enormous amount of anger, and he wanted to escape. When you're 24 years old and you're voted the most popular, best trumpet player in all of America over people like Louis Armstrong and Dizzy Gillespie, whom you know have it up on you in a lot of ways, that's a tall order to fill.
I dim all the lights and I sink in my chair. The smoke from my cigarette climbs through the air. The walls of my room fade away in the blue, and I'm deep in a dream of you.
This seemingly vulnerable, tender, fragile, sweet, romantic sound seduced a lot of people into wanting to get close to Chet Baker. When you heard music like this, how could your heart not melt? And this is true of Chet Baker throughout his entire life. People heard this and they wanted so much to believe that that was the human being that they were actually going to encounter. In fact, the realities of a drug addict's life are very different than that. Drug addicts lead very ugly lives. Mm. They have to steal, they have to cheat, they have to connive in order to get what they need. And yet there was undoubtedly that little sweet, tender part of Chet Baker. It might have been tiny inside him, but that's where the music was coming from. And that's the part of Chet Baker that people clung to because it was so seductive that people wanted desperately to believe that it was true.
You don't know what love is.
That's why it made them even angrier when they knew what was possible than when he would get up and perform with, like, awful missed notes. It would enrage people because all that talent, everything going for him, the American dream, and he blew it.
That is the American perception of Chet Baker, and the opposite was true in Europe, because in Europe they thought that he was a great artist with a great problem. They felt incredible compassion for Chet Baker because even at his weakest, you felt that you were in the presence of a sagely broken poet who had so much wisdom to impart and had gone through hell in order to bring you that music. And people's hearts melted. And what I want to say on this subject is that I don't consider Chet Baker's life to have been one of missed opportunities or chances destroyed, because this guy made 150 albums approximately. With very brief exceptions scattered throughout his life, he never stopped playing. Sometimes the places he played were dumps, but he was bringing the music to the people. And I don't think that it's fair to dismiss a life of incredible accomplishment. I mean, I think most of all, what draws us to him is the fact that he makes us feel something. It may be sadness, it may be pain, it may be disappointment, whatever it is. When you hear him, he gives you something to take away with you.
James, thank you for the book and the music and talking to us about it.
What a pleasure for me. Thank you.
James Gavin is author of the new book, Deep in a Dream, The Long Night of Chet Baker.
Let's get lost in each other's arms. Let's get lost, let them send out alarms.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young, and on this Memorial Day, we leave you with our honor roll, some of the names of the 162 Americans killed in the recent Iraq War.
Narson B. Sullivan, North Brunswick, New Jersey. Osvaldo Orozco, Delano, California. Joe J. Garza, Robstown, Texas. Jesse A. Givens, Springfield, Missouri.
Sean C. Reynolds, East Lansing, Michigan. Jason L. Diebler, Coburn, Virginia. Marlon T. Rockhold, Hamilton.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is
.com.
This is